Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As we prepare to celebrate Independence Day, my guest today takes us back to the summer of 1776 when delegates across the 13 colonies met in Philadelphia, embracing a rather sudden shift in opinion from asserting autonomy from Great Britain to declaring complete independence. Along with a barely functioning Continental Army, led by George Washington, staring across New York Harbor at the largest armada to ever cross the Atlantic. That armada, led by the brothers Admiral Richard and General William Howe, were ordered to ruthlessly crush and suppress this nascent rebellion to bring the colonists back to the empire. Eminent historian Joseph Ellis says these two stories are actually one, which he retells in his most recent book, Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. It's now published in softcover from Vintage. Ellis is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Founding Brothers. His portrait of Thomas Jefferson, American Sphinx, won the National Book Award, and he's the author of 8 previous books on the founders and founding of the Republic. In Revolutionary Summer, he gives us insight into what our founders were actually thinking and not thinking when they signed that document, and gives us interesting insights in the mindset of what was happening that momentous summer. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Joseph Ellis, it's a great pleasure to have you on Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thanks so much for having me.
In your latest book, Revolutionary Summer, you tell two stories of the summer of 1776. A lot of times authors will spend more on one of these stories, and you actually combine them quite well. The creation and signing of the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia and the disastrous military campaign in New York. And I've always found that I just thought of it so interesting that, you know, here you are creating a nation, and meanwhile you're watching your army actually disintegrate before your eyes, and it was only through the leadership of Washington that the army survived, the Continental Army.
Well, you're right. I mean, most people tell one side of this story or the other, and most of it is the Philadelphia side, the Continental Congress side, the play 1776 side. The military side, the defeat on Long Island and Manhattan, they're a single story. They interact. You can't understand one side without the other. I mean, the real reason, here's one elemental fact for our listeners, and that is that, you know, why did consensus for independence form in late spring, early summer of 1776? It had nothing to do with the constitutional issues that had been raging for 10 or 15 years. It was a simple fact that for the first time, the Americans realized they were about to be invaded by a 42,000-man British Army and Navy, and that's what galvanized popular opinion in the countryside. And it was pretty sudden. I mean, it was a matter of just months. And watching that happen in such a fast way in the summer of 76 gives a historian or a writer an opportunity to tell a story that seems to me to be one that most people haven't heard before.
You mentioned the invading army, and in fact, I was surprised to, and hadn't really thought about it, but you said this was the largest expeditionary force to come across the Atlantic until the Americans would go back to France in World War One.
That's right. That's right. It was huge. Half the British Navy was involved in this, and the invasion force was larger than the city of Philadelphia. So the British ministry had made a commitment to squash this emerging rebellion at its inception in the cradle. And they were not going to hold back. They were going to throw everything they had at it. And that's what they did.
Now, you also tell a bit of the story of the Siege of Boston and the opening conflict. And you also mentioned the Battle of Bunker Hill, in which Americans inflicted grievous casualties on the British. Mm-hmm. That had an effect on the British. But I think you also write, which I never heard before, the way the British treated the casualties on the American side, basically bayoneting them, desecrating them on the battlefield, at least in New England, solidified opinion there.
Oh, yeah. This definitely made it into the press. And what you're specifically referring to is the Battle of Bunker Hill was a real bloodbath for the Brits. 2,200 Brits went up, and only about 1,000 came back. General Howe was one of the leaders of the attack, and he had a staff with him. He thought this was going to be a cakewalk, and he had a staff, and one of the members of the staff was holding a tray on which there was a bottle of Brandy, I believe. Well, the staff of six was wiped out, and but you know, he was never hit himself. But as a consequence of the extraordinary casualties, when the British have actually forced the Continentals to retreat from the redoubts at the top of the hill, they were so upset and so enraged at seeing so many of their friends and comrades die that they started bayoneting all the wounded. And there's a famous American martyr there called Warren, James Warren, who becomes really the first martyr in the American Revolution. When word of this gets back to Britain, of the defeat itself, one retired British general was heard to say, a few more victories like this and the British Army will be annihilated. It had a huge impact in several senses. It had an impact on George III. It was really the event that made him think, for the first time, he's going to have to squash this thing militarily. And it made a big impression on Howe, General Howe, who from that time forward never led a frontal attack against an American position. He would always take some sort of flanking movement because the lessons of Bunker Hill were really emblazoned on his mind. So Bunker Hill's a big deal.
Yeah, and you mentioned General Howe and his brother Admiral Howe had the British fleet. It was interesting
right.
that the British set out to crush this rebellion and crush it probably without quarter in certain ways, but the Howe brothers themselves believed that the support for the revolution was only skin deep, and our sort of 20th and 21st century parlance, they were out to win hearts and minds.
Yeah, they were out to fight a kind of, not an all-out war, an all-out battle in which the goal was to annihilate the enemy, but to sort of deliver some sort of proportionate pain and suffering that would convince the Continentals that it wasn't going to work. If there was ever a chance for the Brits to win the war, that was it. Once the war continued and certainly, once the French come in, and once it drags out, it becomes a British version of the Vietnam War, and support for it back in Britain continues to erode. So the big chance for them to win is right at the start, and neither General Howe nor his brother Richard Howe really have that goal as their primary goal. They want to deliver a sort of a blow that then, as a result, they can negotiate an armistice and a treaty. They were empowered to do that, and that was their biggest goal. They wanted to go back to Britain not as war heroes, but as peace heroes. And after the Continentals are pretty much almost eliminated on the Battle of Long Island in August of 76, they call for a parley in Staten Island, and the Continental Congress sends a delegation to meet with Richard Howe, and it's in the Stone House on Staten Island, still there. And what Howe says is, look, we've just demonstrated to you that you can't win the war. Let's stop this nonsense, and let's go back to being friends, and let's return to the British Empire, and we'll give you all the rights you wanted. You get a right to tax yourself and legislate for yourself as long as you stay within the empire under the authority of the king, and which is what the colonists had asked for a year ago, but now it's too late. And Howe says, you really don't have a chance. And Benjamin Franklin, one of the three people, says, Lord Richard, the truth is you did not have a chance. You're overcommitted. You cannot win this war against a whole people. And then Howe says, well, we could easily have destroyed your army. And John Adams says, we'd just raise another army. he said, well, we would have killed Washington. We'd found another Washington. So for the first time, you begin to get a sense of the kind of war this is going to be, and that the colonists, Americans' view of this is not as a war between armies, but as a war between peoples, and the space of the North American continent is a big ally. So if you ask the question, at the beginning for me about, well, which of the following two propositions is most true? A, that it's a standing miracle. It's what Washington said, that this ragtag group of amateurs can defeat the British Army. Or the real truth is that the Brits really didn't have much of a chance. And I think it's more the latter than the former. And I think our own experience in 20th and 21st century imperial roles in the world and Southeast Asia and in the Middle East makes us aware of the strategic dilemma the British were really facing.
I found that to be some of the most interesting parts of the book, is that the fact that Franklin and Adams knew that time was all they had to avoid was a crushing defeat in which your army is completely destroyed.
Right.
You know, you don't have to win the battles, you just have to live to fight another day.
Well, what Washington begins to understand, it takes him a while, it goes against his natural aggressive instincts, but what he begins to understand, and this is a huge, though elemental insight, that he doesn't have to win. The British have to win. All he has to do is not lose. That is a big difference. And it defines the way he's going to fight the war in what they call a war of posts or a Fabian strategy. It's not quite a guerrilla war because he is a conventional army, but it's it means that he doesn't fight unless he has a strategic and tactical advantage. And that's what he does the rest of the war. Yeah. Or tries to, with exceptions, because he's, as I say, it goes against his instincts. He's a 6'3¼, 202-pound natural athlete at the peak of his power at this moment.
Well, let's switch to the other side of the story, and that is what's happening in Philadelphia, which, of course, later Washington loses Philadelphia as well in the war. But at this point, the Continental Congress is there. And you talked about this sudden shift. It was the shift of the invading army. But as you mentioned, it's even as early as some of the first sessions in 1776, they were saying, at the beginning of the year, they were saying, they wanted to basically be a British Commonwealth, you know.
Well, what they're proposing, you know, is a relationship between Great Britain and the American colonies that would have been a discovery of the British Commonwealth 100 years before it happens. They were basically saying, we want to control our own tax and internal legislation, but in terms of being part of the British Empire economically and under the titular leadership of George III or the British monarch, that's fine. That's what they wanted. The British were, it was one of the biggest blunders in the history of British statecraft that they don't do that. Both William Pitt in the House of Lords and Edmund Burke in the House of Commons embraced that position as the right position for Britain, but they were overruled. So the evolving position in Philadelphia in the Continental Congress from the winter to the spring to the summer of 76 is initially the moderates under the leadership of the Pennsylvania man Dickinson, and they're in the saddle still. And it's public opinion changes for two reasons. The one that I mentioned, namely the sudden realization that they're about to be invaded, and this huge invasion force is forming to come get them. It's also big for them that the invasion force includes about 15,000 to 20,000 Hessians, because the Hessians are hated because they don't take prisoners. And the second reason, usually identified as the most important, but I think is the second most, is the publication of Tom Paine's Common Sense, which comes out in January of 76 and is spread, sells about 150,000 copies, which is huge for that population, in February, March, April, which is the first attempt to argue that we have to connect not just our connections with Parliament, but with the King himself. Popular opinion shifts, not quite overnight, but really suddenly. And when the Continental Congress sends this request to all the colonies saying, you should redo your colonial charters as state charters. Well, if you're going to do that, then you know you're going to seek independence. And so it's the de facto Declaration of Independence. This is in May 15th. Adams wrote the resolution. He always thought that was the real Declaration of Independence.
Well, and I wanted to mention that because, you know, if we know Jefferson was the author of the Declaration of Independence, what you write in this book, that John Adams was the architect.
Yeah, he was. And Adams was Adams and his cousin, Sam Adams, were the two people that forced the radical position on the Congress. And then George III and his ministry played into their hands. Must remember, Massachusetts is occupied at the time, so the people in New England, and Massachusetts especially, tend to be more radical on this issue because they're experiencing the full power of the British military at the time, and have had martial rule declared there. But they are the people, and in the play 1776, this is pretty clear. It's, you know, they got that very right. What's not quite right is nobody actually signed it on the 4th. I mean, we're about ready to celebrate Independence Day, and there really isn't any reason why we celebrate the 4th. Adams thought the day was going to be the 2nd, because that's the day they voted on the motion for independence, that these colonies are and have a right to be independent states. And he sent a letter on the 3rd to Abigail saying, on yesterday, the 2nd, will be the day that, in which we have parades and illuminations. He gets everything right down to the fireworks, but he gets the day wrong. The only thing they did on July 4th was send it to the printer. They sent the revised edition to the printer, and then the printer put July 4th on the top of the first copy, and that's how it got to be July 4th. Most of them signed it on the 2nd, and there's a famous painting hanging the original in the rotunda of Congress called the Declaration of Independence. And if you look it up on the internet, there's a lot of versions of it, that many of the versions say July 4th. It shows five people coming up to this desk in Philadelphia, and three of the people are quite recognizable, Jefferson, Adams, and Franklin. And everybody thinks it's the signing ceremony. It's not. It's the day, it's not July 4th, it's June 28th. It's the day they present the draft of the committee that drafted the declaration, presents it to the full Congress. And I always argue that the 4th's always been the wrong day, but Adams and Jefferson in their old age decided to make it the right day by dying on the 4th.
1826, that's right.
Correct. And so they said, what the heck? They're already doing it. We might as well make it right.
My guest today is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, Joseph Ellis. His most recent book is Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. It's published now in softcover by Vintage, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, what was really interesting as the Declaration begins to take shape was what was mentioned and what wasn't mentioned. Delegates were mindful about what they weren't going to discuss at that particular point. Mm. Anything having to do with slavery, voting rights for those not holding property, women's rights. I think you have this wonderful exchange of letters between John and Abigail Adams. I don't think that was as serious as the other two, but those other two were very serious and divisive issues. And they didn't discuss that in the Declaration, which makes it all the more interesting that Jefferson inserts what I think you refer to as our American creed.
Right.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and to secure those rights, et cetera.
Governments are instituted among men,
right,
deriving their powers from their just powers from the consent of the governed. Mm-hmm. Those are the most famous 55 words in American history. And it smuggles the liberal agenda into the document. That's because you can now read those words to mean women should be given equal treatment and the right to vote. Slavery is wrong. Racial segregation is wrong. I mean, when Lincoln fights the Civil War, he cites in Gettysburg that these are the words that justify the end of slavery. When Martin Luther King appears on the Lincoln Memorial steps in August of 63, says he's there to collect a promissory note written by Jefferson. And so the irony is they never discuss that. They really debate the Declaration for a day and a half, and they make 127 changes in the document. They make no changes in that paragraph. Not because they think it's perfect, but because they don't care about it. They think it's an rhetorical overture of some sort. And it's unclear how much Jefferson knew what he was doing, too. But there's a new book out called Our Declaration by a woman named Danielle Bell that argues that this is the basic rationale for a multicultural America, for God's sakes. Now, I can tell you right now, that's not what Jefferson thought. the meaning of those words has expanded over the centuries and in a way that it is the creedal statement of the American people now.
And yet at the time, here you are, when you think of the Continental Army, who's fighting in New York and dying in New York and dying of smallpox and dying of disease even before the British attack.
Yeah, that's disease always kills more people in wars up until the 20th century.
Most of those army members probably couldn't vote in this, you know, at this declaration.
Yeah, they were, that's right. I mean, they especially in the core of the Continental Army that. In the summer of 76, there are no real veterans because the war is too new. But the people that become the core, the people that sign up for the duration in the Continental Army, are not representative of American society. They're the poorest people. They're the former indentured servants. They're the ex-slaves. They're the recently arrived Irish immigrants. They're the dregs. They're in the army because they got no options, if you'll excuse the language. But I think that they win the war. But if the game is survival and just holding together, they are the center that holds. They stick it out. And most of these guys at the start are 17 years old. And every, you know, heroic depiction of them that, you know, shows them wounded without clothes and without shoes is absolutely correct. They suffered. You know, I talk about elites a lot. I talk about the leadership, the Washingtons, the Adamses, the Jeffersons, and those are, in this case, very, very crucial. But the poor people at the bottom are the heroes here too. A lot of them get slaughtered in the summer of 76. The ones that some of them get put on prisoner ships that they live out the rest of the war in the New York Harbor, and mortality rate's almost 80%.
Hmm. Well, to Congress's credit, as this war goes on, they begin to realize that the unlanded citizens of this new United States or America probably should have the right to vote. And that's one of the things they do correct. But it's interesting, you write, after the Declaration, Congress began taking up the task of basically creating some sort of working government. And there, you write, that the blissfully romantic honeymoon is ended, and the debates mark the end of virtue and the beginning of interest as the dominant influence. And
we're going to have a 7-year period in which the government is called the Articles of Confederation. It's a confederation. Sovereignty resides in the states. The first clause of the first sentence of the most famous speech in American history is historically incorrect. Lincoln at Gettysburg said, 80 years ago, our forefathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. No, they didn't. They brought forth a confederation of sovereign states, provisionally united to win the war and then go their separate ways. And that's the problem, that you can come together and say we support what they call the cause, which is the war. And the cause has almost spiritual significance. But there is no such thing yet as the American people. People are Virginians or Massachusetts, New England types. It's that there's real divisions, regional divisions and state by state, and even local divisions within the populace. So it's going to take 7 years for that to be changed. I mean, as we look over, as we speak here in this day of 2014, what we want to call it, the chaos and morass in Iraq, we had similar problems at the very beginning. That is, there was no such thing as the American people. There is now no such thing as the Iraqi people. They're a series of sectarian groups. And that makes winning the war all the more impressive because they had to try to maintain some kind of coherent union in order to make that work.
It was really interesting as this debate takes on in the late summer. You see a lot of the themes that would be echoed in the Constitutional Convention
a decade
later. How do you proportion the population as far as do states get one vote or do they have proportional to their population?
Right.
How do we handle slavery? How do we handle all sorts of issues?
Who's going to vote? For the first time, as they now are going to be independent, they've got to have a government. They've had to face for the first time what that should look like, and it turns out there's all these problems that are going to be problem is at the Constitutional Convention that even the convention doesn't completely resolve, as we all know that there is going to be a thing called the Civil War. So the summer of 76 is a time when we first begin to look at the problems that will preoccupy the government of the United States for the next 70 or 80 years.
Well, also at the time of Continental Congress writing and signing the Declaration of Independence, there are still an awful lot of loyalists in America. In fact, the Howell brothers pretty much admitted they felt like they were coming home to New York because the population of New York was...
When they landed on Long Island, they didn't land as conquerors. They landed as liberators because most of the people on Long Island were Tories or loyalists. There were American historians that have studied this over the years have said that the total population of loyalists in 76, 77 was about 19%. But it wasn't evenly distributed. There were very few loyalists in New England. Most of them had already been driven out in 75. But in Pennsylvania and New York and pockets of the Carolinas, there is strong support for the empire. And most of the loyalists, for the good reason, think that the radicals, the people supporting independence, are crazy. I mean, how can you possibly win this war against this powerful army and navy? In the early stages of the war, the Howe brothers enjoy the fact that they benefit from the fact that they happen to be attacking in New York, where the largest assemblage of loyalists on the entire continent live.
And
it probably made them more confident of what was going to happen after that than because they kept thinking that the rest of America was going to look like that, but it didn't.
And what did the losses at New York, first on Long Island, then across Manhattan, and then up around White Plains, the Army has this series of devastating defeats, but they always get away at the end.
Yeah, I mean, if they were really a well-disciplined professional army, they would have been annihilated because they wouldn't have run away. So the best thing they could do was run away, and they really did that very well. But Washington starts the Battle of New York with 28,500. Half of those are militia coming in from neighboring New Jersey, Connecticut, some in New York, even from Massachusetts and Virginia. By the end of the battle, it's tough to know because the numbers are hard, but about 6,000. He's got about 6,000.
Wow.
Yeah, he's lost 20,000 and or more. Now, they're not all dead. Most of them just ran away. One of the interesting things I discovered that I didn't know before is that the British expected the humiliation of these defeats to sound, to strike popular opinion in America and make them change their minds about this revolution. But it was really not going to work because the press never reported it. You guys in the press were patriots, so if you lived outside New York, you thought we won these great victories. It's amazing. I did a study of 15 newspapers spread up and down the coast, and Washington was afraid that once the people that the soldiers that ran away went back home, they'd tell the truth, which I'm not sure some of them did, some of them didn't. It's hard to know. But initially, we thought we won, and because that's what was reported in the press.
Interesting. That's an interesting book, Revolutionary Summer. Joseph Ellis, thanks very much for joining us, and happy 4th.
Happy 4th to you, Rich. Best to Tulsa.
Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Joseph Ellis, author of Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence, which is now out in softcover by Vintage. That's Studio Tulsa for today. I'm Rich Fisher. Have a great 4th of July holiday.